The following podcast is a production of the Washington College of Law at American University. Any unauthorized use or distribution is strictly prohibited.
Well, this is an integrated curriculum panel. I guess in the interest of integrating the elective into the regular doctrinal courses you have, this is the first year we've done the elective. We're just in the interest of integrating those professors with the other courses. We invited professors here today to discuss their elective classes and then just talk about how they relate to each other and how they relate to the doctrinal class. So,
starting from my left.
I was born in the water.
Well, it's hard to know how to proceed since we don't know how to proceed. But one of the things I thought we might do is just very briefly talk about elective that we're teaching and some of the connections that we see, and then open it for questions or discussions that people have, because I think the topics that we're covering actually a lot of things we've already discussed in the first year. I'm in the I teach with Professor Grossman and Professor Lover's Introduction to the Ministry of Law and Regulation, and that's kind of a greatest hits of administrative law we look at, and we focus on essentially the principles of administrative law by looking at two specific areas: food and drug law and whistleblower protection. And it just seems to me that administrative law is a kind of fundamental course that overlaps with almost everything that you covered in the beginning. And I think some of the ones that some of the connections that strike me to begin with. First is most of the regulation of safety that occurs in the United States doesn't occur through tort law, it occurs through administrative action. And it's very interesting to see, having taught courts in the fall semester, in Professor Grossman's discussion of food and drug law, how much of that relates to topics and problems that he covers. And the way of looking at administrative regulation as an alternative or a supplement to a court system that we're primarily familiar with in dealing with issues of safety and public injury. We talk about a lot of things that you would be familiar with in common law, that's the organization of the government, the separation of powers, the requirements of due process, specific doctrines like standing or likeness are also important doctrines in administrative law. So there's a great deal of connection between essentially administrative law and constitutional law, and that's not surprising given that administrative law deals with the organization and structure of a particular part of the government and how that connects to a lot of principles in constitutional law. Regulation is administrative law is particularly relevant in regulation because of the conflicts or tensions that exist in a lot of the first year courses between looking at some regulatory or institutional approach to dealing with a problem or relying upon individuals' decision making or upon the market as a way of resolving issues. And that's also a particular tension that runs throughout a lot of the administrative law and the topics in particular that we're concerned about. If you love cost-benefit analysis in tort law, you'll love cost-benefit analysis equally in administrative law, where not all but almost all governmental regulations have to pass some kind of cost-benefit analysis. You would find that all the things you learned about cost-benefit analysis and its indeterminacy are equally applicable when you're looking at it in an administrative context. I think the biggest connection is that it's not possible to deal with almost any field of law, real estate,
case where states are going to have to become involved
in safety without coming in contact with government administrative agencies at some level, local, state, or federal. And fundamentally, you can think about the issue that we're exploring in this election. issue of how does the law regulate the discretion that these government officials hold. And here's the thing about these government officials is that they're unelected. So what kind of structure the discretion of unelected government officials in a way that we can have some confidence that that discretion is being used for the purposes for which we're doing. I'd be happy to talk about this more, but you can see that essentially, from my viewpoint, this elective on administrative law deals with one of the concentrations of bureaucratic power in the United States. One is government agencies, the other would be private corporations. So the administrative law is a kind of, I think, a necessary component to understanding and thinking about how things work in our society, so it's not surprising that it's connected with everything. To my right.
I'm Rick Wilson. I'm teaching the elective on international law and litigation in the United States. And I also direct the International Human Rights Law Clinic here. I was thinking, as Robert was talking about, his integration of administrative law, how crucial administrative law is to the work that we do in immigration in the clinic, and how the work of international law permeates at that level of bureaucracy in the way that bureaucracy works and in the way that international law gets implemented and works its way into the U.S. legal system. And that's been our path in the course. This morning, I see a bunch of my students in here, so they've already heard this question this morning, but I told them tomorrow I'm doing a talk for the Pennsylvania Bar on continuing legal education. That is a panel at the end of the day on civil rights practice in Pennsylvania to make the case for why international law is relevant and how a lawyer in Pennsylvania can use it. And so I said to my class, "What do I tell them? What do I say to them?" Absolutely. And they wrote me a great speech. So it's really a challenge. And I think Professor Chuang and I share the international law subject matter this semester, and I think it's always a challenge to try to figure out how to think about international law not just in its exotic manifestations in international tribunals in the United Nations, but what about the way it works on the ground and the way that most people are going to practice law? Most of you, I'd say the odds are that you'll end up practicing law in the United States and practicing law in courts in the United States, or one way or another, doing litigation, maybe in government, maybe administrative law will be a big part of what you do. Litigation may be a big part of what you do. It certainly will be what a lot of people imagine they will do when they come to law school. And whether or not international law integrates nicely into those other first year required courses that you have, I don't know. I'll let Jamie make the case for that. But I think what I heard most from my students this morning, and what would be a sort of hallmark of what I would say to the lawyers tomorrow, is that to ignore international law in a globalized world is to be short-sighted, if not ineffective, as a lawyer. And to think about the ways that the local has resonance in the global, and that there are lots and lots of ways that can happen. I think that's true with trade. I think that's true with any transaction that happens in the United States that a lawyer might be involved in, that we can't escape the way that those issues are affected by cross the active state doctrine, and we were sort of marching through one of the leading cases on that area, Bonzo-Nazianabe-Fuwa-Bavatino, a daunting case. But we went through every single area of the subject matter that you all have dealt with, and when we got to Erie, and it was in there, everybody, I could hear the moan from them. Where did you see this? Yes. I thought it was in common law, but they actually got it in civil procedure. So, when you talk about the way international law operates on the ground and gets incorporated into the United States legal regime, you can't do it without an understanding of the basic grounding that you all are getting, certainly in common law, which are probably the two places that we see the greatest interaction with in the course right now.
Now that I've been assigned a task of talking about how international law relates to the different first-year courses, you're going to hear about it. All right, so in our course, in my courses, and I see so many of you from my class this morning in this classroom, my course is a little bit different from Professor Wilson's in the sense that I'm not focused on international law in the U.S. context. Our course looks at international law more broadly than that. So with respect to CivPro, I'm going to go down the list, the first year courses, and tell me if I missed something. CivPro, we look at jurisdictional issues a lot in the beginning of the international law course. Trying to figure out when states have jurisdiction to consider claims raised by foreign nationals, when states want to give up jurisdiction in claims against in the foreign sovereign community that we look at that issue, act state defense to some of the same issues. And we look at CIPCO, or we look at CIPCO issues, and more specifically common law issues, when we're looking at that relationship between international and how do we translate international law into the domestic realm. And so the question of separation of powers comes into play in terms of who within our U.S. branch of the government has the power to enter into a treaty? And what does it mean to require the Senate to offer, require two votes of vice president as opposed to having the House involved in the decision of whether or not the Russian enters an international agreement? So we look at separation of powers issues in that context. In terms of property, we look at property sort of tangentially when we look at issues concerning expropriation. Right? I mean, expropriation is essentially the international analog of taking. And so we haven't gotten to that component yet, but we will be looking at expropriation in the investment context. And in terms of contracts, treaties are like contracts between states. And so we look at treaty interpretation, some analogs to contract interpretation, and the sort of questions about bargaining power, relative bargaining power between states, those sorts of issues come up, and again, we'll look at that more critically in the context of foreign investment and bilateral investment treaties. So in that context, we look at also issues concerning more powerful states, negotiating investment treaties, less powerful states negotiating investment treaties with terms that could be unfavorable to them when they're dealing with state corporations. Those raise issues expropriation of property. So, for instance, in a bilateral investment treaty context, two states enter into a treaty that basically says that each state will afford the same level of treatment, so it won't discriminate against a foreign company that comes in and invests in its country. And so it sets up, often these treaties set up a power dynamic where you've got your less wealthy countries agreeing to all sorts of concessions to foreign investors, which can lead, if they're enforced, can lead to claims of expropriation. So, for instance, if an investor has the right, an investor can come in under a bilateral investment treaty and say, look, you by passing environmental regulations in your country that have an impact on whether or not I can operate my plant, that's an expropriation of my property in the investment. So we see questions concerning property issues arising out of essentially contracts between states that create favorable terms, particularly favorable terms for certain investors. So those sorts of issues relate to property contracts. And then criminal law we covered today, in fact, we're looking at individual accountability for human rights abuses. So we looked at war crimes tribunal. We talked about the ex post facto principle and to what extent this would apply at the international level. How do we get around the ex post facto principle in dealing with crimes that aren't written down, right? Because international law, the sources of international law aren't just from treaties, which are obviously written, but also from norms that have been developed in state practice. And so how do we deal with trying to assign individual accountability for crimes that aren't written down because we don't have an international criminal code? So we look at those sort of criminal law principles at play in the international realm. So those are just a few attempts that kind of link to specifically. Did I miss any first?
Tort.
Human rights, tort, you know, bad things that you do.
Tell you absolutely everything that is true about their case when they come in.
surprisingly enough, they haven't actually gone to law school often. So they don't really know what's a tort, what their contract was a problem. They know they've got a problem. Somebody's trying to do something to them that they want to stop, or they want to get something that they don't yet have, and they don't know what to do about it. So even with the best of motivation, they are not really sure what's important. You, as not yet experienced lawyers, are also not sure of what's important. I mean, you remember certain things, say, from first year, but if you're a student in this class, you have to figure out, well, how do I figure this out? I'm kind of finding out. And you believe and see. And of course, what you learn is through a variety of techniques, you'd be surprised what you can learn from such simple things as being a good listener, understanding what the perspective and the context of the client might be, trying to probe in areas where you need to probe, trying to step back and listen to the client without having to jump right in and show how well you can spot issues, which of course is what we ask you to do in a lot of our other classes. So some of them might have to use the kind of our calendars to allow you to do in the other classes. But at the end, I think you come away with both of these things are important, and as our argument, which is an understanding of how like legal doctrine works, how lawyers think of important things like agency. But also how lawyers move and manipulate that. How, at the end of an interview with a client, if you can't answer certain questions, you may need to go back to that client. How better lawyers have to come back less, because they have done their work in the first place in an open-ended kind of way. You also learn that the interactions you have with clients and with entities are not this kind of stick-figure, read-on-a-page type of thing. That is, these are real people. Even in our simulations, they're kind of real people. I think some of the are more real than others when they play some role. But that's sort of fun too. So I give the same role description to the, there's 19 students in the class, so half the class gets a client in one case, and half the class are the lawyers in that case, and they switch. And sometimes people play the same, I mean, they literally have the same words written down, and they play the roles completely different. Their personalities are different, they want to give their classmate a hard time, they don't want to give their classmate a hard time, whatever it may be. And although there's a kind of unreality to it, the nice part is that's the way it works in life. The same client has the same kind of problem, and one client wants to sue and sue the bastard, and the other client is scared to death of the client. And both have the same kind of problem. And you know, there's no right answer to which way they ought to go. The right answer is they ought to go the way they want. Your job as a lawyer is to help them figure out what set of choices they actually have, what the pros and cons might be. Things they might not get caught. And sometimes making it safe for them to not pursue something that they think they're supposed to. I had a problem with me. I know I better sue them. What do I do? Well, let's step back. Maybe there's a way to resolve it. That's sure to them. Maybe we have to sue them. That question of do you sue them or not, that's a down the road kind of tactic question. That's not really ultimately getting at what you want. So we spent a lot of time actively doing things, doing specific cases of simulation problems. Videotaping them and showing the versions of the videotapes so I can find the most embarrassing things the students do and portray them to the entire group. And we try to live
living color.
Right, exactly. Yep. And we also learn all the vagaries in the past of the UCL audiovisual system, which I'm not always a hat in hand. But the point is, I think that it was really critical that we actually thought about that we, as important as adding different substantive areas to the first year of week 8, which I think was very much something we wanted to do, also add these kind of courses. We could clearly add many more. But the point of it was to say, let's look a little bit at what lawyers do. And one thing from my standpoint that's interesting is teaching this course to first years is a little different from teaching it to second and third years. And usually when I've taught it before, although it's nominally open to both second and third, it tends to be a third year course, often a second semester, third year. Students who maybe haven't taken it yet and want to do something that they consider to be not practical. So I think we talk a lot about ethical issues that could arise in lawyer-client interactions. Of course, you haven't had ethics yet, so sometimes the responses people have are not as informed by what the rules say, but that doesn't mean they're not valuable discussions to have. And then lastly, and I'm going to actually have to run because I'm supposed to be at another integrated section, discussion or integrated curriculum discussion. That one thing that is something that traditionally law school tries to get away from, but that I think a course like this demonstrates reason not to get, is that although you are novices in the law, you come here with lots of life experiences, lots of other things you've done that actually translate well with the activities lawyers engage in. So if you've done counseling of rape victims or victims of domestic violence, where juveniles were involved in the criminal justice system, you've already done some of the kinds of things that lawyers would need to do. And yet, sometimes your role in those things is a little bit different. So that one of the things we look at is, if I say, have you ever, you know, have you ever conducted an interview, well, of course, everybody's probably that. Have you ever been interviewed? And so you can actually draw on some of those things. What did you like about it? What was a good interview for that? What is it about that interview that figured out something about you that you wanted to say, well, you know, just some time to know who I am a little bit. What didn't you like about the interviewer who was kind of, you know, taking phone calls on his cell phone, doing, you know, what is it about that that you didn't like? What about the other side? When did you remember trying to find out information about somebody when you thought you were very defensive about it? And why was that? Why were you defensive? Right? Did you have a connection with someone? Are you, how are you interviewing people who are very different race and culture and gender? Is that harder? Is it easier? It's easier to actually interact with people what difference is from, because you actually pay attention to what their concerns are, as opposed to assuming, oh, I know what someone looks like. He's from that same time along as I. Oh, he must have a phone. So, I love to see the penis. Any questions you have about me, if you're going to ask these folks, I think we can answer some.
How about thinking, why don't we hear from you about how you appreciate the option of having an elective course in your first year. There's a lot of discussion among the faculty before they introduce this option. So you, I'm sure you can imagine what your first year would have been like without the option of an elective, and maybe it'd be nice to hear from you about why you chose a certain subject. Is it something that's related to a specific career goal? And if not, you just chose on the basis of some other interest. Maybe talk a little bit about how it's added to your first year experience.
I think it's actually really interesting because I think on the one hand, I didn't realize that, and I'm, maybe this is a wrong conclusion to draw, but I didn't realize that our property and civil procedure were made one semester each in order to fit in the elective, which in retrospect, I feel like maybe it would have been easier workload-wise had they remained as two separate semesters. But on the other hand, and I don't know, maybe other people don't feel like this, but it was so nice to finally have something to look forward to.
I didn't love your class.
I think that maybe I should stop talking. It was really nice to have something to look forward to.
I thought it was really helpful because, I mean, I didn't come to law school with a specific knowledge of exactly what I wanted to do. And the earlier you let us experiment with kind of topics and what we like and figure that kind of stuff out, the easier it is for us to say, okay, well, this is the direction I should be looking in for internships and things like that, and what programs are offered in this area that I really like. So I thought that it was really helpful in that respect.
Did you actually find it helpful for your first years for summer jobs?
Not for summer jobs, but for a program that I applied to for later.
I'm sorry. I'm
that's okay. I was just going to say to piggyback off of that. I was the opposite. I knew, it, and it's a handicap, actually, to know exactly what I want to get into. And I'm, you know, I was trying to be as open as possible, but first semester was killing me because it had nothing to do with what I wanted to do. Not really, like, significantly anyway. So, but having the elective was good because it allowed, you know, I knew that this was what I wanted to get into, and it kind of just confirmed it in my head when I was doing the readings and in class. Like, those are the issues that I'm interested in, and it was good to get a head start on it since it's kind of not a, like, required prerequisite, but it's kind of, like, encouraged to take, like, a survey international law course before you go into other. So I thought it was a good head start.
I have two different points of view on it. One, I kind of actually am a little disappointed that we did miss out on some things in the property. I feel like maybe that would slightly put me at a disadvantage from other schools. But on the other hand, I love the fact that I was able to take international law in my first year because it colored a lot of the way of my next 2 years are going to go. I'm finding out some things that I like more than I thought I would, and things that maybe international law is not what I thought it was going to be also, so that's going to help me really shape the next year, which is, I'm finding very important because you have a very limited number of classes you can take, so I really appreciate that. But I do kind of feel like I wish we had that extra credit, so, especially so.
I was going to say almost exactly the same thing. A little concerned about some of the things that we might be missing out, like a lot of things in SIPPRO that we didn't cover that I look at the book and I think, oh God, what is that going to mean later on? But, and because I really like property. But that's the value, what I'm getting out of the international class was worth it, I think.
I was going to say the opposite. I was going to say that considering that DC is concentrated with law schools and some get electives and some don't, we get them, and that's one thing that we have over them. So I thought that was really nice. So I'm glad to compete in any way that we can. And I also find it very enjoyable to have such a wide variety of topics, international law, but two different ways of thinking about it. How great is that? And then IP, which a lot of people I know are interested in, but they don't really know anything about, and a practical course. So I think that WCL gave a very wide range of, I guess I could do an advertisement for the school, but I really thought it was a good idea, so good job.
Well, this is really specific to me, but I'm going on the dual degree program with Fran, so I only have another year left. So to me, it's really helpful to have already been able to take a class, because otherwise my schedule's really tight next year, in my last year. So I really appreciate being able to have that time and get in an elective before, you know, I get into some really substantive classes in what I want to do.
I guess for me, I can only really speculate on what the difference would have been having it's like civil procedure and property spread out over a full year. But from what I understand, they did civil procedure once a week for a full year. Is that right? They met one time a week.
When I thought it was three times a week in the fall and two times a week in the spring.
Okay. Never
mind. Yeah, so did they add
four credits? Both.
So now instead of three and two,
it's
four.
No, it's it was five credits, so it's three and two and four.
Yeah, so they didn't really cut it in half, I guess.
Go ahead.
I think it's I agree with a lot of other people that I think it's good we had a chance to get exposed to some bits of law we might not have had a chance to see before. Like I don't think I've never really done anything with IP before. I'm glad I had a chance to take a look at it. That said, I do think that at least some of the electives offered this semester for 1Ls were compressed too much. At least like the IP elective I thought really should have been like two or maybe even four credits just so we could fit in all the stuff in there which had to get cut out to fit it into a two-credit class, like the international components in particular. And I sort of feel like we compressed the CivPro and the property and the standard core curriculum for 1Ls, and then we got the compressed second semester lesson. So it felt like everything got squished a bit more, so we got to see a bit more, but like the depth just may have been sacrificed a bit too much on the required stuff and on the elective for the semester.
I have a question, and I guess it actually kind of distinguishes what Ethan just said. From what I see in the course catalog, there is no intellectual property course. There's trademark, there's copyright, there's patent law. There is no intellectual property course, so elective intro to intellectual property. Obviously, that's been crammed because they're fitting three topics into one class. But the question I have is the class that is offered at WCL as the title states, international law, administrative law, all that. What's the difference between what you guys are teaching 1Ls now and what I guess any of us would take later? Like, what's different from intro to international law from the international law class that Goldman teaches or the administrative law class you're teaching versus what Popper or Lovers or whoever else would teach that's offered as well?
I can say that in constructing the international law elective, one of the goals was to create an elective that if you took that elective, you would be precluded from from taking the broad survey for national law. But they're supposed to be substitutes for each other. So in terms, more concretely, I taught the international law survey course last semester. We cover the same material. I teach it a little bit differently, but it's the same. Everything that I taught students in my upper level international law course learned last year, my first year students are learning this year. So to the extent that you're concerned about construction, that's not the case.
I think that's true for mine as well. In fact, I think as a proposal to the curriculum committee, of course, I'm international law and litigation in the United States was new to the curriculum. And it was, I originally proposed it as an upper class course in exactly the same format that it was offered for the first year. And was asked to, since it was just on the table at the time that we were looking at the elective, we knew a lot of you were interested in international law, and that we could probably fill two classes of it. We moved that one down into the first year. I didn't redesign it at all, and I think everybody in the course has been able to manage the concepts. So some of my concerns about doctrinal preparation for a course are, I've been totally satisfied with that. Are you prepared to tackle a course like that? I don't think any other school has offered that particular course as a first year course. It's a 3-hour course, and it wasn't compressed in any way for the elective. So I think for my purposes, I've been very pleased, and I think my intuitive sense was that students in the first year could tackle the conceptual framework as easily as anybody else. Occasionally, I'll stop and sort of check on things, but I think we're pretty comfortable, all of us. We don't feel as though we're overwhelmed by the doctrinal concepts that come from another course that you may not have had yet, that wouldn't allow you to grapple with the
A magistrate law was designed so that it would not include be taking administrative law in the second or third year. So that's why I started off by saying, in a way, it's the greatest hits in administrative law. But what the attraction of teaching the elective, I think what it offers that's different than the traditional administrative law course is that it's also a kind of bottoms-up course. Usually in administrative law, it's a very abstract and complex area, and you sometimes don't have any sense of how these principles actually operate in specific situations. So in the elective, we limit the number of general principles that we're focusing on and the depth that we've looked at them, but in return, we spend some time looking at how these principles of administrative law work out in a couple of specific areas. One is food and drug regulation, and the other is whistleblower protection. So I think it offers something that basic administrative law, of course, doesn't offer.
I think one thought I have about taking from a number of the comments, particularly those that had to do with the sense that maybe we give something up when we compress two courses that were a year before. I think the tension for us designing the curriculum is always the tension between your autonomy as students and our sense of what you need to know for your own good, right? So we tell you you have to take it because it's good for you. And I think the trend is towards autonomy. And I think it's consistent with the observation about the earlier I can exercise my autonomy so that I can make choices about my career and have an array of choices, the better I like it. Every teacher who teaches a course will tell you, and I did it in my course, you got a casebook, you can't possibly cover it all. And so you make compromises about that. The property teachers and the people who taught CIVPRO for the full year obviously make compromises and pick what they think are the essentials of it. And they're
spirited debates about whether that's the right thing or the wrong thing to do. I think, I for myself, not having had a stake in teaching it, teaching a course, a three-year course, or a four-year course, it's a little easier. But it does feel to me as though if I'm asked to make choices about what are the essential issues in a doctrinal area, I ought to be able to tell you what the most essential things are and that you need to know to be able to practice or have command of that doctrinal area. And I love the fact that we have, that you have the option to not only look at doctrine, but look at practice. So that what you've learned from Professor Dinnerty, I think it is absolutely key to what this school is all about in helping you be prepared to practice the first day on a GR.
So I never met a client.
I guess we're, other people are starting to come in, so I guess
yeah. Thank you all.